Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Makers of Scotland, Picts, Romans, Gaels and Vikings, by Tim Clarkson, narrated by David Vickery. Introduction. Objectives. This book aims to provide a narrative history of Scotland from the eve of the Roman invasion to the final phase of the Viking Age. It encompasses 1,000 years of social, political and religious development, in which various groups and individuals each played their part. The book's subtitle names four of these groups: Picts, Romans, Gaels, and Vikings, all of whom contributed to the shaping of Scotland's medieval identity. Two others, the English and the Britons, are intentionally absent from the subtitle. Their omission does not diminish their role in the narrative. Indeed, both peoples were major players in early Scottish history, and are accorded due prominence in the following chapters. Omitting them from the subtitle is rather an acknowledgement that their names convey no specific sense of time and place to the reader. By contrast, the mention of Romans and Vikings indicates the broad chronological context, while the naming of Picts and Gaels emphasizes that this is a book about Scotland's ancient inhabitants. The narrative begins at the end of the 1st century BC, in the years when Rome began to take a keen interest in the British Isles. It then follows a chronological path tracing Scotland's origins through the ensuing centuries to the Battle of Curram-on-Tweed in 1018. This is not a study of topics or themes. Broad subjects, such as warfare and economics, are incorporated within the narrative. But the main purpose of the book is to present a linear history. The sole exception to this rule is Christianity, a topic forming the main focus of three chapters, which together chart the decline of paganism, the establishment of churches, and the increasing role of the clergy in political affairs. Sources. The period covered by this book includes the 3.5 centuries of Roman rule in Britain, from AD 43 to circa 400, plus a further 600 years, which eventually saw the northern part of the island evolve into the Gaelic-speaking kingdom of Alba. Only a segment of what is now Scotland was brought within the Roman Empire, but the unconquered portion remained a source of trouble for the imperial authorities, despite many attempts to subdue it. Military campaigns launched against the northern peoples were documented by Roman writers, whose accounts represent a rich vein of data on early Scottish history. After the empire abandoned Britain in the early 5th century, Roman texts effectively ceased to mention Scotland, their disappearance depriving modern historians of a contemporary record of events. Sparse information relating to the 5th and 6th centuries does exist, but much of it was created retrospectively by writers of a much later era, who were less interested in historical accuracy than in reconfiguring the past in ways appropriate to their own purposes. This means that today's historian must sift each textual source very carefully, in the hope of unearthing fragments of genuine early information among passages written in the 12th or 13th century or even later. Reliable sources from the first millennium AD are scarce and are usually biased in favour of political or religious interests. A typical example is Bede, a northern English monk whose lifetime spanned the 7th and 8th centuries. Not long before his death, in 735, he completed his greatest work, The Ecclesiastical History of the English People, in which he frequently made reference to the peoples of early Scotland. His book is a valuable contemporary source and a repository of fascinating detail. But notwithstanding his reputation as a meticulous scholar, the ecclesiastical history needs to be treated with caution. Bede was not a historian in the modern sense, but a monastic writer who regarded history as the unfolding revelation of events predetermined by God. This meant that he constructed his narrative in ways that allowed him to demonstrate how the English, whom he believed to be a chosen people, like the Israelites of the Old Testament, enacted God's will among themselves and their neighbours. Insofar as the people of early Scotland were concerned, Bede saw some, such as the Picts, as playing a positive role in the divine plan, while others, such as the Britons, whom he regarded with contempt, were earmarked by God to suffer well-deserved woes at the hands of English enemies. The ecclesiastical history is therefore coloured by its author's biases and preferences, and is not the sober textbook it might seem at first glance. Contemporary sources written in Scotland are few in number. There is no Scottish equivalent of Bede, and only a handful of eyewitness or near-contemporary accounts relating to this period have survived from Northern Britain. This does not mean that reliable information cannot be found, but the task of identifying it is made more difficult. Our most detailed source is a group of texts known collectively as the Irish Annals, originating as year-by-year entries in records maintained by monasteries. These texts refer not only to ecclesiastical matters, but also to events in the secular world. Although the various manuscripts in which the annals survive were written no earlier than the 12th century, their information was copied from older documents and can be traced back to lost texts compiled many centuries earlier. One of the lost compilations was a set of annals maintained at the Hebridean monastery of Iona, a religious settlement established by the Irish priest Columba in the 6th century. The annals were destroyed when Iona fell prey to Viking raids, but a number of entries were incorporated into the two main Irish compilations, the Annals of Ulster and the Annals of Tiernach, to preserve a valuable account of Scotland's early medieval history. Iona's annalists had a keen interest in political affairs and noted important events such as battles, alliances, and the deaths of kings. Like Bede, however, they were not immune from bias and crafted their words carefully, selecting events they wished to write about and ignoring others. After the middle of the 8th century, the Iona entries in the Irish Annals cease, but Scottish information continued to be recorded in Ireland throughout the Viking period and beyond. Some of this data was spurious or inaccurate, or was added to the annals retrospectively, or was amended much later by scribes when manuscripts were being copied. Rigorous modern analysis of the surviving texts has revealed numerous problems and pitfalls, but has enabled the older, more reliable entries to be identified, thereby allowing the Irish annals to be used as a valid source for early Scottish history. Other types of literature are generally held in less high regard, mainly because of the lateness of their manuscripts, even if they seem to contain material of older origin. Into this category fall the Pictish and Scottish regnal lists, schedules of the reigns of kings, together with a plethora of poems and stories. All of these texts tend to be incomplete or ambiguous, or found in different versions which contradict one another. Some include fictional characters drawn from legend. Genuine historical information, or real history, is frequently present, awaiting identification and extraction. But it is all too often embedded in impenetrable layers of later, less reliable material. The king lists of the Picts, for example, are a rich source of information, and are often widely used as chronological guides, despite posing many questions of their own. Many of the figures named in the early or upper portions of the lists are clearly fictitious. Some historical kings are listed in one or more groups of manuscripts, but are then ignored, perhaps deliberately, in others. Equally controversial are the vitae, or lives of saints, generated by writers attached to major Christian cult centres. This type of literature is called hagiography, and is encountered in several chapters of this book. Here, it will be sufficient to mention that the genre has little in common with modern biography. Even the renowned abbot Adovenan of Iona, who wrote a Vita, or Life, of Saint Columba at the end of the 7th century, cannot be called a biographer, regardless of the fact that he was born only 30 years after Columba's death. Adovenan was an author of great eloquence and knowledge, but his motives in writing the life were not those of a modern historian. Like Bede, he viewed past events through the lens of his own biases and prejudices. As Bede's contemporary, he nevertheless provides a useful Gaelic perspective to balance the strongly Anglo-centric focus of the ecclesiastical history. Scotland's early history is full of gaps. It is not a complete or accurate record. Basic detail is lacking for many important points, such as the ethnic and geographical origins of certain kings or the locations of lost kingdoms. To compound these problems, the information given by the various sources is often contradictory, allowing different interpretations to be drawn. When uncertainty arises, it is not always confined to obscure events or to little-known individuals, as the case of Kenneth MacAlpin, illustrates all too clearly. This enigmatic 9th century king is examined more closely in Chapter 8. But here, in this brief survey of the sources, he becomes a useful example of just how incomplete the picture can become. Kinnaid is one of the most famous figures in Scottish history. The king traditionally credited with unifying the Picts and Scots to form a single nation. but he is also one of the most controversial. The problem lies with the sources, which seem to be so unclear about his origins that they fail to answer the most basic questions about him. Who was he? Where did he come from? Was he a Scot or a Pict? Faced with such ambiguity, we feel tempted to seek answers in places we might normally avoid, even turning to the bogus histories written by John of Fordun and Walter Bauer in, respectively, the 14th and 15th century. Today, the temptation to consult such works is less compelling than it appeared 100 years ago, chiefly because Fordun and Bauer are better understood today. Their status as custodians of supposedly genuine tradition is now being vigorously challenged. Tradition is itself a rather vague term, but it appears from time to time in this book, usually in relation to information of dubious reliability. Folklore and legends, often of localized origin, fall into this category. Most historians are rightly skeptical about the use of such data, even if it appears to be old. But some acknowledge its value as a starting point for discussion, where reliable information is otherwise lacking. A few traditions relating to early Scotland are of great antiquity and seem to preserve nuggets of history concealed among works of poetry or saga. The enigmatic Berkhan's Prophecy, for example, appears to contain many such nuggets and is therefore regarded by historians as a potentially useful source. Although preserved only in a manuscript of 1722, it appears to have been originally composed in the 12th century from older traditions circulating at that time. It is a difficult and controversial source, but among its cryptic verses is a group dealing with Scottish kings of the 9th to 11th centuries. With careful handling, these verses can sometimes be used to add flesh to a sparse entry in the Irish annals, or to an allusion in a 12th century chronicle. Terminology. This book deals with a period before the country, now called Scotland, came into being. Thus, although the narrative is chiefly concerned with Britain north of the River Tweed and Solway Firth, only a portion of this area was regarded as ethnically or politically Scottish during the period studied here. In chronological terms, the book traces the history of northern Britain from the end of the Iron Age to the birth of medieval Scotland. This was an era when indigenous peoples, such as Picts, Scots, and Britons, became more or less distinct from one another in the eyes of contemporary writers. Only in the final chapters of the book, during the time of Kinnaid MacAlpin and his heirs, does an embryonic Scottish identity begin to appear across a broad swathe of northern Britain. Whenever the term Scotland is used in the following narrative, the meaning is usually geographical, relating to the physical landscape rather than political or territorial. The adjective Scottish is also used either in the specific sense of pertaining to the early Scots or in reference to abstract concepts such as Scottish history or Scottish landscape. Another adjective is British, which, like Scottish, can be used in a specific as well as a general way in early medieval contexts. Historians sometimes use it to describe a particular ethnic group, the Britons, in studies of the period before circa 1100. It is used here as a broad geographical term, in phrases such as the British Isles, or in the narrower sense of pertaining to the Britons. The latter were regarded as an identifiable ethnic group by Roman writers in the 1st century AD, and continued to play a separate political role throughout the period covered by this book. Most personal names appear here in native non-anglicised forms. Domnall and Dovnawal are therefore preferred to Donald, while Kinnaid is preferred to Kenneth. The exception is the Pictish name Constantin or Causantin, which appears in this book in its more familiar form, Constantine. Other Pictish names are Gaelicised, with Unius, Nectan, and Bruder representing the likely Pictish forms Anuist, Natan, and Bride, respectively. This choice of nomenclature might seem obstinately old-fashioned to supporters of the current trend for presenting personal names in the original languages of their bearers. In fact, the choice reflects nothing more than the present author's own preference. The same can also be said of names borne by Britons, a people whose native language was similar to the ancestor of modern Welsh. Nowadays, these names are increasingly appearing in published works in archaic forms, rather than in those found in medieval Welsh literature. Here, the later forms are retained, with names such as Dovnawal and Owain being preferred to archaic equivalents such as Dumnuel and Eugain. Structure. The following chapters form a continuous chronological narrative spanning the first millennium AD. Each chapter deals with a segment of this chronology. Viewing Scotland's early history in this way will not be to everyone's taste, but might suit those who prefer to read history as an unfolding tale of years. The alternative is the looser chronology offered by chapters devoted to broad themes. As previously stated, this book's only real concessions to a thematic approach are the three chapters dealing with Christianity, the first of which includes a study of pre-Christian pagan beliefs, which the new religion supplanted in the post-Roman period. The book's final chapter provides an overview of the 10 centuries to AD 1000, and looks at how particular aspects of the millennium were perceived in later times. It also considers other issues, such as modern attitudes to Scotland's archaeological heritage. Chapter 1, BC to AD. At the dawn of the Christian era, the British Isles were inhabited by people whose society was essentially barbaric and prehistoric. Neither of these labels implies primitiveness or backwardness, despite attempts by Roman writers to portray tribes living outside the empire as untamed, unsophisticated, and, in contrast to Roman decadence, admirably uncorrupted. In describing the ancient inhabitants of Britain and Ireland as barbarians, we're simply distinguishing them from native communities in mainland Western Europe, who had already fallen under the heel of Rome. Barbarian societies were typically those in which large urban settlements and a coin-based economy were absent. The first millennium AD began with much of Western Europe already in Roman hands. Within the empire's borders, native cultures were being steadily eroded by a deliberate process of Romanization. This meant that in areas such as Gaul, roughly coextensive with modern France, the distinctively Celtic character of indigenous society was giving way to the Latin culture of the conquerors. One major casualty was the ancient Gaulish language, a branch of the same linguistic group to which the tongue of the Britons belonged, which faced extinction after being replaced by Latin in all important forms of communication. Thus, at the beginning of the first millennium, the still unconquered British Isles represented the last bastion of Celtic language and culture. In those days, the northern part of Britain was not yet called Scotland, nor was the southern part called England. The whole island was regarded by Roman travellers and other contemporary observers as a single geographical entity called Britannia. All of its inhabitants, regardless of whether they lived on the southern coast or in the far northern isles, were known collectively as Britons. Their language, usually referred to by modern scholars as Brittonic or Brythonic, was the ancestor of Welsh, Cornish, and Breton. Like Gaulish, it formed part of the P-Celtic linguistic group, which had already started to diverge from the Goidelic or Q-Celtic group when the first millennium commenced. Q-Celtic includes the Gaelic languages of Ireland, Scotland, and the Isle of Man, all of which derive from a single ancestral tongue once spoken in many shorelands around the northern waters of the Irish Sea. Giving any group of ancient peoples the label Celtic is not an exercise in precision, but rather a convenient way to identify them as non-Roman, non-Germanic inhabitants of northwestern Europe. The Celts were not in fact a homogeneous race, but a myriad collection of communities linked by similarities in culture and language. Most of the ancient people now described as Celts would have been puzzled to find themselves lumped together in modern history books, as if they were all members of a single ethnic group. The idea of a common Celtic identity is actually a fairly modern concept, promoted by 19th century historians searching for an umbrella term to encompass large areas of Europe, including the British Isles, which appeared to share features of a common material culture in the first millennium BC. The name Celts was borrowed from the Celtae or Celtoi, a people inhabiting parts of southwestern Europe when the region was conquered by Rome in the first century BC. These folk were neither the creators of Celtic culture nor, in ethnological terms, the ancestors of other Celtic nations. Their name was merely chosen as a convenient label for a prehistoric North European culture, first identified in the 19th century at archaeological sites in Switzerland and Austria. A more accurate use of the label Celtic restricts its application to a distinct subgroup of the Indo-European family of languages. It is less appropriate to give it a cultural or ethnic dimension. In this book, it is therefore used as an all-embracing term for speakers of a Celtic language, regardless of whether they lived in Gaul, the Iberian Peninsula, or the British Isles. In the narrower context of early Scottish history, Celtic is often used by historians to distinguish the natives of northern Britain from the Germanic immigrants with whom they came into contact during the first millennium AD. Settlements. Celtic language and culture were well established in the British Isles and in parts of mainland Europe long before Rome grew powerful enough to build her empire. Historians and archaeologists formerly believed that a Europe-wide process of Celticization occurred during the middle of the first millennium BC, as part of the transition between the Bronze and Iron Ages. Iron was certainly replacing bronze as the main material for tools after 600 BC, and its use in everyday life is rightly seen as an indicator of Celtic influence, primarily because the Celts were the first ironworkers in northwestern Europe. Changes in the design and location of dwellings in Britain also occurred around this time, and have often been attributed to the spread of Celtic fashions from Gaul. In particular, the fortification of isolated hilltops is strongly associated with the Celts, and many examples are found on the European continent. The presence of similar hill forts in Britain and Ireland is thus seen as further evidence of Celticization crossing from Gaul to permeate insular, i.e. British and Irish society. Conventional wisdom, rooted in past scholarship, has tended to explain these social and cultural changes in terms of a mass migration by Celtic groups from mainland Europe into the British Isles after 700 BC. This has recently been challenged by an alternative explanation, which, rather than imagining waves of seaborne immigrants, suggests instead that the Celtic languages and cultures of Britain and Ireland were largely homegrown. In this scenario, the idea of new linguistic and cultural influences arriving from outside gives way to a simpler theory, which sees the peoples of the British Isles and continental Europe developing a shared Celtic ness as a natural evolution of their common Indo-European origins. Any migration from the European mainland in the first millennium BC would probably have involved small numbers of people, such as groups of ambitious Gaulish warriors seizing power in certain areas of Britain and Ireland, from where they perhaps disseminated foreign influences among the natives. This would mean that the ancient Celtic peoples of the British Isles were not newcomers from elsewhere, but the descendants of an indigenous population whose ancestry lay in the pre-Celtic past, and whose ultimate origins reached back into the Stone Age. If Britain and Ireland became Celtic without the need for a mass immigration of European Celts in the first millennium BC, then other factors must account for the changes that make their societies recognisably Celtic to modern historians and archaeologists. The practice of constructing compact, defensible hilltop fortresses can thus be explained not as a fashion imported from Gaul, but as a Europe-wide phenomenon arising from a need felt by some communities to make their homes defensible against attack. The likeliest cause of such insecurity was a perception that society was becoming more dangerous, or to put it another way, that some communities were behaving more aggressively towards their neighbours. The first hill forts in Scotland were constructed in the Bronze Age, around the beginning of the first millennium BC, and were usually larger in area and fewer in number than their later Iron Age counterparts. Ramparts at some of the smaller forts nevertheless enclosed substantial surface areas containing many houses, giving these sites the character of protected villages. Other sites were even smaller, with only a few dwellings inside, but would have seemed more imposing to onlookers when located in positions of natural strength. The people who commissioned the construction of hill forts and other enclosed settlements were clearly capable of mobilizing large labor forces. They were either powerful kin groups wielding authority at local level, or entire communities undertaking cooperative projects. Earth, stone, and timber provided the raw materials for rampart construction, but the actual designs varied considerably. The basic shape could be curvilinear or rectilinear, while the enclosing rampart might be a simple wooden palisade or a massive earthen bank. In some cases, a palisade replaced an earlier earthwork, the former perhaps seeming, to modernize at least, a less substantial, less effective type of defensive feature. A more elaborate technique involved adding timber to unmortared dry stone walls, either by bracing with long wooden beams or by making a box-like framework. In Scotland, the distribution of these timber-laced forts covers a wide geographical area, from Broxmouth in Lothian to Colican, Craigfadrick, and Burghead in the northeast. Some were destroyed by fire, presumably at enemy hands, with temperatures rising high enough to fuse stone and timber together. The resulting process, known as vitrification, left the affected parts of the ramparts with a glassy appearance, which so reduced their strength that a burned fort became unsuitable for reuse by its former occupants. Aside from such cases, many hill forts fell out of use within a few centuries of their construction, either through destruction or abandonment. Others continued to be occupied, with or without occasional breaks in habitation, into the first millennium AD. In a few cases, the period of occupation was remarkably long, and, as subsequent chapters of this book will show, a small number of northern hill forts were still being used as late as the Viking Age. The larger hill forts, constructed around 1000 BC, were essentially substantial villages enclosed by ramparts. Their usefulness in military terms was minimal, mainly because they were too large for their inhabitants to defend. There were never many of them, and most were abandoned when a trend for smaller forts began to gather pace in the final centuries BC. Some large sites nevertheless continued in use, serving Iron Age communities as major centres, and perhaps assuming the role of local capitals. Their sites added prestige to their occupants, even at those sites where an exposed or elevated position made habitations seasonal rather than permanent. When the Romans encountered such places in Gaul, they frequently described them as oppida, a term found in Julius Caesar's account of his Gallic campaigns. One of Caesar's most celebrated victories came after a prolonged siege of an oppidum at Alesia, a site defended by strong earthworks, similar in appearance to those at the major power centres of Celtic Britain. The impressive remains of British oppida can still be seen today, most notably in southern England, at places like Maiden Castle and Cadbury Castle. Hill forts in Scotland were generally smaller, with even the largest barely matching the southern examples in size. This has not deterred archaeologists from applying the label oppidum to sites such as Aildon Hill. This has not deterred archaeologists from applying the label oppidum to sites such as Aildon Hill North and Trepane Law, both of which are situated in the lowlands. Indeed, it is possible that these two settlements serve the kind of proto-urban function commonly associated with their Gallic and southern British counterparts. Whether this involved permanent habitation rather than seasonal or occasional ceremonial use is hard to discern from the archaeological evidence. Both were probably first inhabited in the Bronze Age, around 1000 BC. In each case, the earthworks enclosed a large area containing the houses of a substantial population. Settlement seems to have been continuous throughout much of the Iron Age, with a marked decline in activity in the 1st century BC, followed by a period of recovery. Aildon was finally abandoned during Roman times, but Trepane had a rather longer existence, its defences perhaps being refurbished as late as the 5th century AD. Why were hill forts built? To this question there are no simple answers. Reasons for enclosing elevated settlements with ramparts and ditches were probably as varied as the number of sites. Some hill forts were surely constructed as protection from enemies, presumably at times of local insecurity, when communities within particular districts faced real perils. The plethora of forts in the Scottish lowlands might therefore suggest that this region was especially dangerous in the Iron Age, although the proximity of many enclosed sites to their nearest neighbours casts doubt on this explanation. Factors other than warfare and raiding could have been at work. A hill fort in a prominent location was an imposing feature in the landscape, and may have served its occupants as a symbol of their group identity, or as a forceful marker of their territory. It is worthy of note that few hill forts in Scotland were still inhabited in the 1st century AD, when the Romans invaded Britain. Perhaps, after fulfilling a range of purposes for many hundreds of years, their usefulness dwindled. Hill forts appeared all over Celtic Britain and Ireland during the first millennium BC, but they were not the only defensible settlements constructed at this time. One type of dwelling found exclusively in Scotland is the Atlantic Roundhouse, a class of stone-built structure with
sample complete. Ready to continue?